We shift gears now to talk about a dramatic, spectacular UFO incident in Wales. It has been investigated impressively by a husband and wife team of filmmakers. Laura Roten is a filmmaker, paranormal investigator, and writer. She was born in the UK, nurtured a fascination for the bizarre and unexplained since an early age. In 2015, she co-founded The Paranormal Scholar, a YouTube channel and website dedicated to the objective exploration of the paranormal. And in 2017, she and her husband, Eric, founded the film production company, one notable for the documentary In Search of the Dead. Eric Roten is a filmmaker, investigator, and writer. He was born here in the U.S., had a near-death experience at an early age that was sort of a catalyst for his interest in the paranormal. And aside for that In Search of the Dead documentary, his well-regarded work includes his investigative work on a documentary on the Penturk, hope I'm pronouncing that right, Penturk UFO incident, and an ongoing cover-up of what unfolded according to eyewitnesses. The Penturk incident is what we're going to talk about for the next 2 hours, and we'll be right back and get started. The Penturk incident is a new documentary put together by Laura Roten and her husband, Eric Roten, filmmakers, paranormal investigators who join me now. Laura and Eric, great work on this. Hi. I watched it today. It was just excellent. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you enjoyed it.
I'll start with you, Laura. How did you and Eric get started down this road? How did you hear about the incident?
A close friend of ours told us about the case. They're local to the area and thought that we would be interested in covering it.
And Eric, you know, as you detail in this film, there was a great attempt to cover the whole thing up. So it must have been painstaking work to dig up the information that you got.
Yes, it was, definitely. We had a lot of help, though. There's some local investigators in the area, Gary Jones, and the witness, Kaz Claude. She herself did a lot of investigating and helped us a lot, gave us a lot of information to put together the documentary.
Eric, can you sort of set the stage for us? So we're talking in February 2016. What are the first hints by residents in this part of Wales that something odd is going on?
Well, the 24th of February, a small twin-propeller plane started flying around the area, doing circles behind Cass Clark's house in Penturk in the area. And people started noticing this, and it was quite low-lying. Her neighbor, Dave, complained at the time to military, you know, there's a loud plane in the area. They didn't think much of it other than it was a nuisance at the time. But as things then evolved on the 26th, it grew to a much larger incident than it first appeared.
And Laura, the calls that come in from residents while this is happening, they're calling up, I guess, local officials, and they're scared because these helicopters are not just one or two flying around, but flying really low over the houses, shaking buildings, right?
Yeah, most certainly. In the town nearby to Penturk, Llantrisson, the Freedom of Information request has revealed some of the call transcripts to police at the time, and you're completely right. People were terrified. The roofs on their houses were shaking. People were concerned for their children, for livestock. There really was no idea what was going on. There was a lot of military aircraft in the air with no warning having been given before. People thought that there was a major incident.
Do you know if there's ever been anything as big as that? Because there is a military base not that far away. There is a big base. But has there ever been an exercise like that over these towns?
In that particular area, no. And as you point out, there is a military base nearby. And indeed, there's land not too far away, which is set aside for the military to use live ammunition, to use all of the aircraft and military vehicles that they would desire. So for something like this to be going on, and we're talking about 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. in the morning over a residential area, is highly unusual.
But, Eric, they do try to explain it away. Oh, no big deal. We have something called Chameleon. It's a training exercise called Project Chameleon, and it's no big bother, nothing to worry about here, nothing to see, right?
Yeah, but there's some holes in that, of course. Operation Chameleon tends to take place in the north of the country most of the time, and there was no warning that this was going to happen in South Wales at the time. It seems as though they changed their plans and they diverted aircraft and resources last minute to this area. There is not really that much of a good excuse for that, really, to say that it was just a planned exercise.
As you say in the film, though, there had been some kind of inkling that something was up for a couple of days and that there were some planes go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I would say this is the biggest mystery. I still can't understand. How did they know that something was going to happen in this area? I think that's something I don't know yet.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Even at the end of it, how did they know? Laura, the hint that they were anticipating something might happen there, because the witnesses that you talked to had seen these planes flying around, these really kind of strange aircraft, right? Spotters.
Yeah,
and also the type of planes that were being used. They're used for reconnaissance. They have sophisticated radar equipment. It was as if they flew into the area, were searching for something, and then something caught their attention, which made them decide to stay. And this was in the days leading up to the 26th. And at the point that they realized they had found whatever it is that they were looking for, other aircraft were then called in.
The other aircraft being, I think we would call it an AWACS. I don't know what the term MOD.
E3 Sentry. And based on research that's been done, looking into radar flight logs and also from plane spotters, it actually seems that there were two of those planes and that one of them was a NATO plane. And they basically monopolized the sky at that point and kept it under some sort of surveillance lockdown.
Laura, you're on camera interviewing this amazing witness named Kaz Clark, who came forward, is sort of the heart of your film. Tell us about her a little bit, how you got her to open up and then share with us some of what she told you.
Well, Kaz Clark is quite vocal about what she saw, and with good reason. In the first year and a half after her experience, she, from what we understand, kept quite a low profile and did speak about what she saw, but in very limited circles. And it wasn't until she claimed she was intimidated by somebody who at first expressed interest in her experience, but then went on to threaten her and her family, the safety and lives of her family, that she felt as though she needed to do more to speak out about what she had seen for her own protection, and also because of the implications of this case and her unshakable belief that people need to be informed about this. So she was, you know, very kind, very willing to speak to us, very coherent. And, you know, we've met quite a few people and listened to a few people's testimonies about all manner of unexplained phenomena, and she really is the best witness that you can hope to speak to. The coherence, the believability, both on and off camera. Just a very, very credible lady.
I have to agree. Eric, so she did, I'm trying to get the sequence of events. Did she put something out on Facebook or social media at the time of the event saying, this was no exercise, and it was after that she was interrogated and kept quiet, or did her story not come out until you folks arrived?
Well, it was at Wales Online, a newspaper in the area, and she put up a comment on the online portal, and she said pretty much this was no exercise. This, you know, and she laid out the story, and she says afterwards that she was interrogated by reporters, and you know, it kind of began from there, the intimidation, and until finally her family was intimidated, as Laura said.
It seemed like it was less of an interview and more of an interrogation the types of questions that were asked of her, right?
Yeah. She said she was badgered basically by the reporter, and it was very rude basically to her from the beginning.
So Laura, help walk us through it. So give us a general idea about the story that she shared with you that she tells in the film.
Well, so as Eric mentioned before, her and her neighbor, their suspicions had started to be raised by this plane that was circling over the village. And there were, in fact, two of these planes that were on shift rotation, seemingly watching the skies. So by the evening of the 25th, they decided we're going to camp out overnight and see what happens. So we're now, it's the early morning of Friday, the 26th of February. About 2 a.m., they noticed the arrival of the AWACS, the E3 Sentry plane. And they hadn't seen this plane until that point, so obviously this was rather strange. And they watch it circle over them the length of the field. This is open countryside and winter, of course, so they have a fantastic view. All the leaves are off the trees. And at this point, they see a red light appear above the tree lines in the distance. And that one red light turns into three. And it's revealed that they are the point of what can only be described as an absolutely enormous, triangular, pyramid-shaped craft. And speaking to Taz at the time, standing in the field with her, she's pointing to the sky and she's saying, if you're looking at the bottom of this craft, you cannot see the top. It was so huge. And she describes that the craft moved across the sky and a separate light, a green light, another craft of sorts, about the same size as a small car, shot out the top of this pyramid craft and proceeded to move across the skyline. There was then, at this point, the pyramid is really lit up with lights all along the edges of it, and it ejects what Kaz has described as a hand of lightning. As it appears to approach the ground, the field, a plasma-like lightning comes out of it and illuminates the entire sky. And at this point, it's completely obvious that she and her neighbor are witnessing a pyramid craft because it's all illuminated. And soon after this, there's the arrival of more military aircraft as the three Sentry plane is still circling. So these larger planes, which she's described as being something like a Hercules, an American aircraft, C-130, come in and seem to approach the green light. By this time, Kaz says that she's turned away from the pyramid craft to look at these planes. And when she looks back, the pyramid craft is no longer visible to her. So anyway, these new aircraft which have entered the scene seem to be interested in pursuing this green light. And the green light, in a way, seems happy to be pursued, almost as if it's trying to divert attention away from the pyramid craft. And it leads the four military planes that have come in away in the direction of Clantrisson, which is a town about 5 miles away from Penturk. So they all leave. And you have Kaz and her neighbor Dave, they're still watching this extraordinary event unfold. And they realize that there are these two additional craft, these bowel-shaped orb objects, which are red, come across the field, approaching them. And one of them stops some distance away from Kaz and seems to be observing them, but the second one actually comes in closer until it's right above Kaz, and she describes being scanned by this object. And after that experience, these objects also disappear off into the distance. And that's what she claims she witnessed in the early hours of the morning.
She seemed very credible to me, standing there on the same fence, looking out at the same field and area where all this unfolded. And it was a very, very credible recitation of the events of that night. Eric, do you happen to know, does the British Air Force have C-130 planes, or would these have been Americans that were participating in this supposed exercise?
The British does have a fleet of C-130 planes. I think, as in research, and I believe that they were British planes.
Yeah, but as I said, the E3 Sentry, we know that was a NATO plane, so who knows who was involved in this.
And then you have three Apache helicopters that enter this whole thing, really low over these fields, going really fast. What were they chasing?
Well, they were chasing the green light, I believe.
Yeah, from the position that they were flying over the fields, it's Kaz's opinion, because she saw these helicopters, that they were on an interception course with the green object, which was being pursued towards Clantrisson.
And the same question, would the British, the Ministry of Defense, have their own Apache helicopters, or would they have? Was there any indication that Americans were involved in this?
The British certainly do have those aircraft, but once again, I cannot begin to speculate on how how wide this goes, your guess is as good as mine in that respect.
Well, you know, as you know, the British and American militaries are quite tied together, so it's hard to tell apart sometimes.
All right, so the big red triangle or pyramid, then the green objects that come out. There's more than one green object, right? There was a bunch of them?
Yes, according to Dave, her neighbor, because Kaz was staring at the hand of lightning because she was transfixed by that, but Dave was looking up and he says he saw a bunch of green lights, green orbs.
Yeah, red and green orbs, which are akin to the bowl-shaped objects, which Kaz then later saw and claims one of them scanned her. As for the green object, the one which was the same size as a small car, as we understand it, there was only one of that object.
So it goes off in this direction. Everyone is chasing it. And how long before you hear this big boom? How long before the witnesses, how much time elapsed?
Well, Kaz claims that she and Dave were standing at the fence for no longer than 10 minutes. That was the extent of their experience once the red light first appeared. And she says that after that, they went back home. And sometime after that, she heard this explosion come from the direction of Clentrison. Now, there is somewhat of a time discrepancy here because we know from seismological data that there was indeed a large seismological activity in the area about 4:20 a.m. Now, her and Dave, when the E3 Sentry plane and then later the first red light appeared, was probably around 2:30 a.m. in the morning. And as I said, she claims her experience lasted around 10 minutes. So there is a bit of a time discrepancy there, which of course then leads you to think about the possibility of abduction.
Yeah,
and
missing
what happened
time.
In that missing time.
Yeah, I mean, she was scanned. Were they both scanned?
She can't say for certain for Dave, because Dave does not speak publicly about this, but she did say that while she remained at the gate, transfixed on wanting to see these barrel-shaped objects, he did retreat away because he was scared. So whether he was scanned or not, we can't say for certain.
So, Eric, there is seismological evidence that there was some kind of an event there. An explosion could cause something like that if it was big enough, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. There should have been nothing around that time of evening, but you could see it quite clearly there on the seismological graph at 4:20. Something quite loud happened in the area.
And I think you went to a hospital that was miles away, and this hospital, I don't know who there spoke to you or confirmed it, but apparently, as you documented the film, is this hospital shook and houses shook and windows rattled. There was a big explosion, according to multiple different witnesses, maybe more than one explosion, right, Laura?
Yeah, and the hospital backs onto the wooded area where the green light, the craft, is said to have actually come down, to have crashed, to have been shot down. So the hospital is rather close to where the explosion is said to have originated, and several people have come forward over the years and have contacted either Kaz, herself, or other investigators connected with the case, saying, I was at the hospital, I heard this, I was a member of staff, I was a patient. People were scared.
We're talking with Laura Roten and Eric Roten about the Penturk incident. There is some physical evidence at a site that the filmmakers tracked down that we're going to get into in our next segment here as we dig further into a very strange case and apparent cover-up that is ongoing to this date. The story we're hearing about from Laura and Eric Roten has a different sort of ending. The Penturk incident sounds like the British military was chasing some unknown craft, a very strange unknown craft, different kinds of lights and capabilities. And then there was gigantic explosion, maybe more than one. And there was physical evidence left behind at a site that we're going to talk about in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Laura, watching the film, the documentary that you guys put together, I've never been to Wales before. I'd like to see it sometime, but it looks rural and beautiful. Kind of reminded me of the Shire in Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's green, there's forests and fields, and tell a little bit about that before we go back to the main story.
Yeah, definitely. So the location that we're talking about is in South Wales, and Penturk is a village. And the place where Kaz had her experience is most certainly rural. It's very open. It's close to the side of a mountain, so it's very beautiful, very exposed in terms of what you can see. And even though we're talking about an area that's about 10 miles outside of the capital of Wales, Cardiff, it does get very rural very fast. So we're talking about single lane roads where two cars wouldn't be able to sit down at the same time. So it's most certainly rural, most certainly very beautiful.
And Eric, I'd imagine people are fairly private out there. They like their privacy. They don't necessarily expect to see cameras like yours showing up to ask probing questions about a very unusual situation, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot more witnesses out there, but they just don't want to come forward. And they see the cameras, they shy away from the cameras. And, you know, perhaps in private they tell you something, you know, kind of hush-hush, but they just want to move on with their lives and not be bothered. Less people in the area, you know.
Yeah, I imagine it was tough, Laura, for you to talk the people who did communicate with you, talk them into cooperating, especially since they were scared.
Yeah, definitely. And as I mentioned, Kaz's neighbor, Dave, who was quite instrumental in the sighting, it's easy to forget, in a way, that other people did see this other than Kaz, because she is the star, the lead witness in this case. But Dave was there at her side. He saw this. In private, he's known to speak about this. But yes, getting people to speak is difficult, and for good reason, because, of course, we know from what Kaz claims that she has been harassed, potentially intimidated. It's not an easy thing for people to talk about, especially because of the military involvement.
So, Eric, you take the camera and follow the evidence, follow the trail in the direction where the green light drew these planes and where the explosion came from. The two of you travel that way. What do you find in the trees?
Well, currently right now, the whole area has sort of been cleared except for the immediate area where it's believed to have crashed. And this is where we see a bit of the physical evidence in the immediate area, because right now you still see strange white burn marks to this day on it. The trees themselves, where it's thought to have crashed, they look like they've been heated up inside and have kind of expanded, like a distended shape to them. It's an absolutely fascinating sight, really. It's almost odd to go there and just see it, you know, in kind of like a park setting and with bicyclists next to you, but and not have a plaque there saying this is where a UFO crashed, you know.
Right.
It is quite fascinating.
From the video I saw, it looked like the trees had been chopped off. Is that, I mean, in addition to, you know, we're going to get into the story about them being removed and the excuse that was given, but did it look like some of those had been lopped off by something that smashed into them, or did I get that wrong?
Oh, no. Yes, so these trees, they're about 60 feet tall and about 20 feet up from the ground. They've been what can only be described as snapped. It's not a clean cut. It's something at force looks to have collided with them. And as Eric mentioned, in the immediate area where the craft is said to have crashed or been shot down, there remains some of this debris even to this day, 5 years later. You can see trees snapped mid-trunk, and they still stand there.
And the excuse given later by after there are teams in there, they remove the trees or chop them down. They give some excuse of some kind of blight or disease or something that is not up to the task of explaining this away, right, Laura?
Definitely. After this happened, so there was originally when Kaz Clark went to this wooded area a few hours after her experience, the debris area was much larger than what remains today. And there was supposed to be more trees snapped. And indeed, she filmed footage at the time, which you can see in the video. And sometime after this, most of these trees disappeared. They were cut down and replanted. And via a Freedom of Information request, Natural Resources Wales, who's responsible for this area, claimed that the trees were suffering from larch disease. And larch disease is a big problem. It can be very aggressive and spread to other trees and kill them. And for this reason, procedure which is normally done is to get rid of them, to fell these trees, is done with a lot of care. And this is according to Natural Resources Wales own guidance, that you would go in there and do what is known as a sanitized felling. And you certainly would not replant this area until years afterwards, if you could, because the spores from this disease can linger in the leaf litter. And yet today there are young trees that have been replanted and were indeed replanted immediately afterwards. And not only that, the trees which were felled are still there on the ground, chopped up, dispersed through the wooded area. They were not removed. It was hastily done and does not match with the explanation that was given.
They didn't do a very good job of telling that part of the story, and they didn't do a very good job of telling all the other parts of the story. Eric, talk to me about military personnel that suddenly show up in the area. I guess there were some were in uniform, and then some you suspect were military pretending to be civilians.
Yes, that's what it seems like anyways, from you know, what we have, the reports and photographs of the day. And there were some military personnel camped out behind the houses, you know, where the event happened in Penturk. And Kaz had actually spoken to them. And at first they were told that they were there doing fracking in the area. And now this caught the attention of all the residents because nobody wants to have big fracking going on in the backyard. Then they were asked again, and they were basically told they were a telephone company just doing some research in the area. But, you know, they had, like, very organized tents, what looked like a big tent, like a commander's tent, basically. They had big military laptops in the area. You know, they had heavy vehicles. I mean, and they did a fingertip. We're doing a fingertip search of the field and all the area around it. So it doesn't sound like a phone company to me.
And satellite dishes, right? Did they say satellite dishes?
Yeah, it seems, from what Kaz and her neighbors and several other people in the village saw, as though they were triangulating a signal, that they were looking for something.
So random campers who set up these tents in perfect military synchronicity, certainly unmistakable in that sense, it's just not random campers. They were pretty organized for campers.
Yeah, definitely. And because their suspicions have been raised, at this point, Kaz and some of her neighbors, they go out there that evening and once again camp out in the field. And one of these campers comes up to them and says, what are you doing? Are you going to be here for very long? Obviously, you know, they did not want them to be there. And Kaz and her neighbors told them, well, we're just out here sky watching. We're allowed to be here. This is a public footpath. And the man supposedly said to her, well, my commanding officer is not going to like that. I didn't realize that telephone companies had a commanding officer. So that was rather strange. And after that, the so-called commanding officer apparently came out and spoke with Kaz and her neighbors and was quite upset that they were there, but ultimately couldn't do anything to make them leave. I think the rain, in the end, drove Kaz and her neighbors away.
So in addition to this, and the same general time frame, a lot of roads are closed. In addition to the public records request you have filed with the Ministry of Defense, you also filed some with the police agencies in the area. What did you learn, Eric, about these road closures? Did they happen or did they not?
Well, Gary Jones did a good job filing these and asking the questions from the police and MOD. And what he found out was incredible, pretty much. So what the original thing that was going on the night, many roads were closed off. Major highways, everything was kind of closed off in the area. And the explanation some people were given, other people just told go away, was that a truck had flipped over, had been blocking up the road. Of course, this wouldn't explain why multiple roads were closed. After some persistence, Gary Jones finally got somewhat of an answer, well, not really an answer, from the police. They pretty much said, we have no records at the time from that incident, and all of the police officers that were available that night are no longer on the service. So make of that what you will.
They're all gone. Ah, well.
Yes.
How convenient.
Laura, part of the story you tell, too, about the site where these six trees had been snapped in half and then cut down, there was, in essence, a microclimate at the time of this incident. What happened?
Yes, so when Kaz went there, so she had her experience sometime between 2 and 4 a.m. in the morning, and then later on that same morning, after she had gone back home, she went into Clantrisson and went into this wooded area trying to find the path of the green light. And when she got there, it was snowing, but only in the immediate area where all these trees were showing this physical damage. And speaking to Kaz when we met her, I asked her, well, was it actually snow, or was it some sort of debris that was falling from the sky? And she was quite certain that it was snow, but that it was peculiar. She described it as spongy, that you could catch this snow in your fingers and you could squash it in your fingers and it would remain there for a moment and then it would dissolve. But that's not normal snow. And why it was falling only in that area, well, who knows?
That's pretty weird. All right, there are these fields where there are bald patches in the fields that I guess are still there, still observable. And there were other kinds of strange phenomena, at least measured, irregularities, I think you call them in the film. Eric, tell me about that part of it.
Well, yes, there's something that's been called like the bald patch. Even today, you can see it marked out there. Vegetation has a real hard time growing there, if at all. This is where Kaz saw the hand of lightning hit down on the ground. Now, also, EMF studies have been done in a bald patch, and they've shown that that there are strange readings in the area. It was done even 18 months afterwards. There were still strange EMF readings in the area, higher than average levels of radiation. And
Sorry, I was going to say... these were taken by the researcher, Gary Jones, who we've mentioned before, who was involved in the case 18 months after it happened. And even then, he claims that the readings were a dangerous level. And as far as we understand, because we're not involved in this part of the investigation, he has now sent these readings away to an expert to be verified, to find out, were they indeed dangerous levels of radiation there after the craft was sighted?
So is Gary Jones the one who's filed the records request with the Ministry of Defense, or did you file some of those as well?
We have filed some, which we're waiting for a response on. But yes, the earlier ones were Gary Jones, and he is still involved with working with Kaz in regards to trying to uncover this. You know, there are several people involved, and they have been involved for a few years, but it does seem like a persistent suppression of information that's quite hard to fight against.
It's almost hilarious. It's so blatant. Can you share with me, Laura and then Eric, some of the responses that have come to particular questions related to this series of events?
Yes. So one that comes up time and time again is what's known as the Section 26 exemption, which is basically the military's way of saying, we are not going to tell you this because we claim that the information is too sensitive to be put out into the public. So it's a convenient way, in a sense, for them to not answer questions. But interestingly, rather than deny that they hold information on record, they say, oh, we do have knowledge of this. We're just not going to tell you. And it's especially interesting in those Freedom of Information requests, which specifically ask about the appearance of the craft, of the pyramid craft, of the green light craft. They don't say, oh, this is nonsense, or, you know, we don't believe in UFOs, and what are you asking about? They say, oh, we hold information on file. It's just, and this is, you know, what they say, that the public interest in maintaining the Section 26 exemption outweighs the public interest in disclosure.
Well, it's amazing. You know, the public interest justifies withholding information for something that didn't happen. Remember, there were no roads closed over. We didn't have guys dressed as campers out there. Mm-hmm. It was just a routine training exercise called Chameleon. Would they release information about Chameleon?
You can find a lot about Chameleon online. You can find out all the, because it's done biannually. It's done twice a year. Usually, there's not really much secrets about it. It's supposed to be an intelligence gathering exercise. It usually involves parachute drops of soldiers. It's all about, you know, kind of recovering an item or something behind enemy lines, men, material, whatever. What it looks like happened on this night, you know, there are similarities in how Chameleon is carried out, but that is the point of Chameleon. Chameleon is to gather something, to pick up something. And it is speculated that how they practice that operation was deployed on this night to recover this unknown object that supposedly crashed in the Pentuck and Clintus, of course.
Well, I can see people asking, I wonder if the military somehow simulated a UFO and then trained their personnel on how to pursue it and capture it and knock it out of the sky. That's a, you know, pretty, that's a scenario.
That's definitely one theory that has gone around is that it was either a real extraterrestrial craft that Kaz and her neighbor witnessed that night, or indeed that it was all simulated. Of course, that could be a valid explanation as well.
But they're not going to tell you that either.
No.
It sure sounds... go ahead, Eric.
As you say, it is quite... I mean, you don't really know what the military holds and how many, what kind of technology there is out there. But it would be quite extraordinary if the military has the ability to, I don't know, create a giant hologram of a UFO pyramid with the barrels and everything flying around. I feel like they're still like light years away from the current technology, in my opinion. But who knows, really? Who knows?
Well, just if they were practicing for that scenario, that also tells us something, doesn't it?
They're preparing
for it.
Once again, it goes back to the question of why were they there before it happened? How did they seemingly know that something was going to happen on the early hours of the 26th?
We're talking about the Pentuck incident with Laura Roten and Eric Roten. They're got a site called The Paranormal Scholar where you can see their documentary on this. It's definitely worth checking out. We're going to continue our conversation after the break and take some calls from our listeners to see what kind of questions you might have for our guests.